Lee, this is Mike. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's a real pleasure to talk with you today.
You too. I'm assuming you're somewhere in the eastern seaboard of the U.S. then, judging by your accent. Or are you Boston?
Yeah, New York City.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, you can't hide the accent no matter how hard you try.
No, obviously not. But when I get these interviews that they come in, they don't tell me who I'm calling. Like, I know who I'm calling, but I don't know sometimes the region, like where I know it's a heavy metal radio show, but yeah. Anyway, cool to talk to you today.
Listen, I'm a fan from way back in the day, and I'm so happy that after 12 years, you know, a new record of new material, and it sounds great. I mean, it sounds like Lee Aaron, like you're back again.
Oh, man, thank you. That is, like, such a huge compliment, and I'm thrilled that you like it. Yeah, you know, it's a little bit of a labor of love, and, you know, when I was making the album, I had my children in 2004 and 2006 and took a bit of a hiatus from recording, and but when I got into sort of the meat of it and started working on this album, I was like, man, I really actually missed being creative and the whole writing and recording process. So I'm glad that you're feeling like you're hearing the results. That's cool.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you take that much time in between records, like I said, as we get older, things get in the way, families take place and things happen, you kind of feel like you're starting over again. And that's hard to say because you have such an amazing career that spans a couple of decades. Do you feel like it's like all new again?
Are you asking if I feel like it's starting all over again?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, this is my first album, believe it or not, officially, that's released in the United States. So, pardon me, in terms of my, I guess, visibility in America, yeah, I would say it does feel a bit like I'm starting all over again. But in Canada, you know, I've sort of sustained this career where even during the last 12 years, I've gone out, you know, every summer and done festivals and a handful of shows here and there, and I've released a variety of things that weren't studio recordings, like I did a 3-DVD rarities anthology and put out another Best of Lee Aaron a couple of years ago to mark, you know, 30 years of having a career in the rock world, and so, you know, it doesn't totally feel, not certainly not in Canada, like I'm starting all over again. And, you know, the week the album came out up here, it sold extremely well. So, you know, I guess fans were waiting. So, you know, so, yeah, I would say, yeah, you know, kind of, it's a double-edged sword, yes and no. You know, I know that with a new studio recording, there's certainly a lot of work to be done in terms of sort of getting it out there and, I guess, having the Lee Aaron name have some visibility again. So yeah, I'm spending quite a bit of time sort of reaching out and talking to a lot of folks and radio people and magazines that I haven't talked to in quite a long time. So yeah, it's all good. It's great.
Oh, I'm glad. Well, yeah, I mean, since The Beautiful Thing came out in 2004, I mean, a lot of things have changed as far as the industry goes. Around that time, you know, downloading was starting to take place, iTunes, you know, the internet exploded with, like, social media. And like you were saying, Fire and Gasoline is, like, the official first album to be released in the U.S. But it seems like today, I mean, you could be worldwide with the click of a button. It's not like the old days where you kind of had to go from country to country and make your name there.
Yeah, you're pretty much absolutely right about that. It's funny because somebody was asking me just the other day, you know, where do we get the Aaron albums down here in the States? And I'm like, well, you know, to be honest with you, I can't tell you which stores you could walk into and actually find a physical copy, but I can tell you that if you go to Amazon.com, with the click of a button, you can get it, you know? It's that easy. And I think most people shop that way these days anyway, so... But yeah, a lot of things have changed, and it's, again, I was having a discussion with a journalist just the other day about this, that it's wonderful in that music is so accessible, and that there's a lot of, you know, that the power has been taken out of this sort of corporate music industry in terms of, you know, big record companies just can't have a monopoly on everything and basically dictate what the audience is going to be listening to, because all these streaming networks and, like, again, just the ability to be able to create and promote your own music digitally online has taken a lot of that away. And so, you know, that's a beautiful thing in many ways for the music industry. But the only downside with that is that when, like, for instance, this new album, Fire and Gasoline, it's, you know, you can buy a physical copy, which I hope a lot of people do. I think a lot of my fans still love to have and to hold and to look at physical product, right? It's like something to be able to hold a CD in your hand and go through the booklet. And I also know that immediately Universal, which is my bigger distribution network that I'm part of, you know, I'm up on Spotify and all these other networks. And I actually, a few months ago, just got my very first streaming royalty statement. And it was shocking because it was the size of a Bible. Like, seriously, it was like thousands of streams, some of which I was paid 0 cents for. Like, I don't even understand how, to be honest with you, how it works. And some I was paid 3 cents for. And anyway, to make a long story short, this huge sort of document arrives in the mail, and it's like, this is your streaming revenue. My check was $56.
Wow.
And I mean, I was, it's crazy. Like, and so I was like, wow, you know. And I know that, you know, my other statements for radio play and different sources of, you know, where my music has been used, the checks are, I wouldn't say huge, but certainly much larger than $56. And it just got me thinking, you know, how are artists going to be able to continue to create and make music if they can't make any money doing it, right? Like, it's just
true.
So I don't really know where this is all going, or if there's going to be sort of maybe a different kind of system set up to monetize music in the future. But yeah, anyway, my 2 cents.
No, a lot of people feel the same way as you do. And when you were talking about record labels a little while ago, I remember back in 1982 being a 15-year-old kid and walking into the record store and hearing people saying, oh, you know, Rick Emmett is working on this record with it's called the Lee Aaron Project. And I remember waiting for it to come out and buying it. And, you know, back then an import record was a small fortune for a kid to buy. And that album blew me away. And that's when I became a fan. And I remember 2 years later, you were like almost reinvented as the metal queen. And I always felt like you were kind of uncomfortable with that, and it really wasn't what you were about, because the Lee Aaron Project was a great hard rock and roll record, and then I felt like, you know, you were something completely different 2 years later. And when you were saying about record labels, people back then, they might not realize how much control a label, you know, there were management, labels, PR people, you know, kind of guiding you and pushing you into the different directions that they wanted you to go to make money for them. Were you ever really comfortable, like, being, like, considered the metal queen? Like, because it seemed like you abandoned it not long after that, went just back to putting out great rock records.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's interesting because you're the only other person that asked me that exact sort of same question was the guys at Vice, and they're an American publication based out of L.A. And like I said, it's interesting that you're asking me that because in Europe, like, they loved the Metal Queen, and they sort of embraced that whole era of my career wholeheartedly. But I know what you're saying. You know, initially, yeah, the whole Lee Aaron vision was just, yeah, straight up, you know, powerful singing, rock, you know, straight ahead rock and roll. And, you know, I guess the whole thing is I wrote this song called Metal Queen, which was probably the heaviest track on that entire album, because Metal Queen was a fairly, I would say, you know, had a lot of melodic and commercial elements to it as well. But, you know, back in the 80s, when there was the big corporate record industry, you know, and I'm not pointing fingers here, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm bitter about the way things went down, or, you know, I'm not that type of person. I mean, the reality was that was just the way the industry worked. I mean, you had these big labels, they had money to invest, and when someone's investing $500,000 into you, they're going to have some say into how that money is spent and what they feel is the right direction for the marketing and how they feel they're going to best get their return on that money. So there was like I said, unlike today where you're almost completely in control of your own music, which is fantastic, back then, you know, there was this whole structure of how it was set up. You know, there's like the president of the label, then there's the VPs, and there's the promotion people, then they're hiring, you know, you have a stylist on your shoot, and then there's someone who's doing art direction that's working with the stylist, and like the next thing you know, you're kind of like, wow, you're walking into, I remember walking into that set for the Metal Queen shoot going, whose idea was the fur bikini? Like, we didn't have this discussion. Like, and I'm like, that's what I'm wearing? And they're like, oh yeah, like we're going to make you this whole, like, you know, it's like, you know, thank you. You owe me a big thank you, Zena, for your look, because, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was kind of, you know, crazy. That whole, the way it all went down. But, you know, and the other factor in play there was the fact that I was really, I went professional when I was 17 years old. I got picked up by this manager who loved my voice, and this flurry of stuff happened to me when, between the age of like 17 and 22, I got thrown into a lot of this stuff, and I was completely naive and a kid, and my parents, who, even though they were sort of supportive and in the background, they really didn't have a clue how the music industry worked. So a lot of this sort of stuff happened, and I was, before I think I had the know-how and the confidence and the sort of strength to sort of stand up and say, no, you know, this is who I am. And, you know, so, yeah, I don't know. I hope that answers your question.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can imagine as a teenager, I mean, you know, you're a musician, you're playing, and all you're thinking about is getting signed to a label and getting a record out. You're not focused on the business part of it or what goes on behind the scenes. So it must have been really challenging during those teenage years and even into your early 20s, trying to, like, you know, figure the whole industry out on your own and have people telling you what to do. You don't know right or wrong at that time. It must have been a difficult thing. But when did you think you came into your own where you said, hey, I know what I want to do, who I want to be, how I want to sound, what I want to do? Was there any one album that kind of defined you being you on your own for the first time without everybody telling you what you should do?
I would say that the album probably that most defined that was Body Rock in 1989. What had happened to us up until that point, when I say us, I'm mostly referring to myself and my co-writer at the time, John Albini. He and I wrote all the material, most of the material for all the records. And, you know, we had worked with Peter Coleman, who, you know, had produced multiple Pat Benatar records. I had worked with Bob Ezrin, who was, well, obviously, one of the biggest producers in the world, you know, done Pink Floyd and Alice Cooper and Meatloaf and a variety of others. You know, the guy was, you know, amazing. But I was, when I worked with Bob, I was like 22, and I was completely, you know, I say this in the kindest way because I think he's, I have such admiration and respect for who he is and everything he's done, but I was completely intimidated. I was like, man, this guy produced Pink Floyd. Who am I? You know, I felt like I knew nothing, you know, but the reality was that up until that point, we had had, you know, success, but not, certainly not in Canada anyway, a huge amount of success. And so I remember before we went into record Body Rock in 1989, we had had this meeting with the record label, and they were looking at a variety of different producers to produce this new album for us because, like I said, up until that point, I'd had some of the biggest producers in the world working with me. And I remember we had this meeting, you know, with Pat Glasser, who had produced Night Ranger. And we were all sitting around the, you know, the big boardroom table, and Pat was saying, you know, that he was, you know, interested in producing us, but he didn't really hear any of our songs. And, you know, and then there was this other discussion, this side discussion that started taking place about, you know, well, what, we own the publishing for some, we got some great songs, and Pat has some great songs that he owns part of the publishing too. And I remember getting out of that meeting, and the label being so excited, this guy's going to produce you. And I remember standing there going like, well, number one, he doesn't really like any of our songs. So did it occur to anybody that maybe he's not the right guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember at that point just going, this is not working for me at all. And I remember we pulled back at that point and we told the label, no, we're not going to work with him. And I mean, not that he wasn't gifted and talented, of course he was, but he didn't hear our material. So maybe he wasn't the right person to produce us. And the label said, well, you know, instead of $250,000, here's $60,000, see what you can do. You know, and I remember we teamed up with our A&R guy at Attic because he was a producer as well and said, let's just do this record on our own. And we had like a fifth of the budget and we went in and we recorded Body Rock in 89 and it went triple platinum in Canada. It was like my biggest selling album here. So
it was. It's such a great record. The one thing I remember about that record more than anything else was the song Hands On, because I think Paul Sabu helped with that song.
He did. I loved writing with Paul.
From Only Child. I remember his father, Sabu, the Indian actor. That one song always stood out in my mind for that reason.
Yeah, he was a great guy. You know, I got thrown into a lot of different writing situations back in the day. They would fly us to Nashville and to New Jersey and Los Angeles. And I remember a lot of the times it was very uncomfortable because you'd be thrown into a room with a complete stranger who decided that was the person you should probably write with. And it was sort of like, this is maybe not the greatest analogy, but sticking your finger down your throat and trying to make yourself throw up. When you, yeah. You know, it's like you've got to try to come up with song ideas with this person, right? And Paul was just a great guy, made you feel completely comfortable, super nice person. And he was one of the, you know, few writing collaboratives that we really just hit it off right away. Yeah, he was great. He was great to write with.
Yeah. Oh, like, you know, your career has taken so many turns over the years and each one different than the last and everyone really great. I remember when Too Precious came out, I think it was Don and Don Benz and Don Short. They were in some band. I can't remember the name. Sons of Freedom they played in at the time.
Sons of Freedom. They were a great band.
Yeah. You kind of hooked up with them for that record. And that was a lot different than things you've done before.
Well, I mean, you know, simply virtue, I think, of the fact that I co-wrote the material and my voice was on it, it had definitely had the Lee Aaron thing about it. But those guys were a burgeoning sort of alternative rock band in the early 90s here in Canada that did quite well. And, you know, I had hired them to play on one of the rhythm section to play on one of my albums in 94. And they just loved working with me. And they said, if you ever want to just make a cool album that's really different, call us and let us know. We'd love to work with you. And so I flew out to Vancouver and we wrote that album together. And I'm still really proud of that record. I think that some of the stuff that I did in the 90s was some of my best work. But unfortunately, like many other, rock and roll artists that were sort of attached to the big hair genre, you know, of corporate, you know, classic rock in the 80s, it was just a bad time because the music industry just did such a huge shift that it was more perception than anything. You know, you just couldn't get arrested in the 90s. So even though I'm proud of that album and I think it was, I think it was some of the best work I did, it was a commercial failure. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It just didn't do anything. But, you know, I want to know an interesting story is that I was playing a show in Toronto a couple of years ago and these guys that were like university professors from England, London, flew over, and because I rarely make it over to the UK, that's hopefully going to change with Fire and Gasoline, but they flew over to see a show in Toronto, and they cornered me, and they both had the Too Precious records, and they were like, this is like our favorite Lee Aaron album, and I'm like, you know, it was worth the thousands of dollars to do that record just to make you guys happy, so... You know, interesting things happen like that once in a while. So,
Yeah. Do you think it's bad when any artist gets kind of pigeonholed into one genre of music? Because some of them feel like they can't move on or explore, experiment. As a musician and as an artist, I mean, that's probably all you strive to do throughout your whole life is experiment with different types of music and styles and sounds, because that's what, makes you whole in the end.
Well, I think so. I think that, well, for myself, it's funny because I've been asked that personally asked that question quite a few times about, why did you go sing jazz and blues? That's just so bizarre and so different. And it's like, well, actually, it's not. For me, I felt like going back and doing jazz and blues was like exploring the roots of rock and roll and the history of where this music evolved from, because really, rock and roll evolved out of that style of music. I mean,
Yeah.
a perfect example is, early Zeppelin. I mean, they stole from all those guys like Willie Dixon and Muddy Waters and, until they developed their own, sort of completely unique style. But, they were heavily, heavily influenced by all of that stuff in the beginning. And, I think, I think that when you explore different arenas of music, I think it just helps make you a better rounded musician,
I agree. I mean, I love the Slick Chick record. I mean, a lot of people are like, but she's not rock anymore. I'm like, what's the difference? If you like an artist, you try. I mean, you may like it, you may not, but you have to at least try it. And I love that record. I was hoping for a lot more after that.
really?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. That was a really, really fun record to make. And I had one of the greatest compliments that I received on that record, believe it or not, was written in Sharpie across the bathroom in a jazz club here in Vancouver. Had a little house installment there for a while, and I remember walking into the ladies' room one night and sitting in a stall and looking up at the side of the stall, and someone had scribbled across the side of the stall in huge letters, "Lee Aaron's Jazz Rocks." And I thought, right on, because my approach live to jazz was definitely a little more hard-edged. And, some of the old jazz and blues artists, man, they were very edgy, so...
Yeah.
but yeah, thank you for the compliment on that album. I enjoyed doing that. Although, I didn't do that album in the anticipation that it was going to be a big payday for me, or, a career trajectory for me that would continue long into the future. It was, yeah, just me doing something on a personal level for, myself, and it snowballed into some jazz festivals in Canada and Europe for me. But yeah, Beautiful Things was a little more of a segue back into, the pop rock realm, and then obviously Fire and Gasoline is taking it one step further. And I hope that on Fire and Gasoline, a few of the reviews have said that they feel that some of the songs have got some blues influences and stuff. And I think you're kind of hearing probably a well-rounded sort of representation of a lot of my influences on that album, even though it is a straight-up rock record.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now with the album out, and are you planning on going out? Is it possible to go out and tour, or are you going to do maybe one-off shows here and there? And if you do, I mean, are you going to like go through your whole catalog?
Well, I think that the new show, I am going to be out this summer doing some shows here in Canada for sure, and then I know that what we are talking about right now, I mean, it's a different world out there than it used to be, in terms of, it just doesn't seem like it's as possible as it used to be to just sort of, string together a whole bunch of tour dates with an album that's just, starting to, how do I explain it? Starting to get a little bit of traction. I think our plan at this point is to see what the response to the album is in all of the different markets, and certainly the U.S. is a market I'm really, really excited about coming down and doing some dates. And we've been talking about starting out by doing possibly a showcase in New York and a showcase in L.A. and see where that leads, and then hopefully putting together a string of dates coming down into your area along the Eastern Seaboard and getting down there for sure.
See, that's one of the pleasures of living in New York, that most artists will come here before anywhere else in the U.S. And if that means getting to see Lee Aaron, I'm going to hold off moving to Florida for a couple of more years till you get here.
Are you going to move to Florida?
In a few years when I retire, I think I've had enough of the cold weather. It's time to get warm.
That's the only thing. Yeah, I got to tell you, living in in a coastal climate here in Vancouver, I don't miss having to shovel my driveway.
Yeah, that's true. You can avoid that, but it's time for the warm weather. Listen, I've been a big fan for 30 years. It was a pleasure to talk with you today. And I hope 30 years from now, when you're releasing your 50th record, we could do this all over again.
Oh, well, that would be amazing. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Lee. Have a great day. And I can't wait to see you live. I do hope you make it here to New York.
It's in the plans. So,
all right, that's
rock on.
That's great.
Take care.
Thank you, Lee. Take care. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye-bye.